The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Sports Talk 1240 is brought to you by DraftPot.com. DraftPot is changing fantasy sports. Register today at DraftPot.com with promo code SPORTSTALK1240 and receive a free $5 credit. And now, Sports Talk 1240.
Well, good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome to hour number one of Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB, Freeport, Long Island, New York. Bill Donahue taking you through the first hour on this Sunday night, the 30th day of August, after which I'll hand it off to Jake Brown for hour number two. Our engineer Brian Graves is across the way. We've got a great show lined up for you tonight. Up first, we welcome in the man who holds the record for the lowest ERA in the history of the original Yankee Stadium, lefty Fritz Peterson will join us. He's got a new book titled When the Yankees Were on the Fritz, Revisiting the Horace Clark Era. In the second half, we'll talk to former Mets second baseman and fan favorite Doug Flynn. So sit back and relax and enjoy Sports Talk 1240 tonight on WGBB. We've got some great stuff ahead in the next few hours. As always, before we begin, I invite you to follow us on our Facebook page, cleverly titled Sports Talk 1240. There you'll find sports information, show information, and more. So stop by, give us a look, and then you can click and give us a like. You can also follow us on Twitter at SportsTalk1240. And all past shows can be heard online at our website at www.sportstalk1240.com. And as we said in the opening, all you daily sports players out there, daily fantasy sports players, Sports Talk 1240's teamed up with a new daily fantasy sports website called DraftPots.com. Go over there, register with the promo code SportsTalk1240. You'll receive a free $5 credit to get yourself started. So head over to DraftPots.com, all you daily fantasy sports players, and get started with your free $5 credit. Well, my first guest is a mainstay on the pitching staff of some not-so-great Yankee teams in the late 60s and early 70s. He holds the record, as we said, for the lowest ERA all time at the original Yankee Stadium. And as we said, his new book is titled When the Yankees Were on the Fritz, Revisiting the Horace Clark Era. I welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight the great Fritz Peterson. Fritz, good evening.
Hi, Bill. How you doing?
I'm doing okay, Fritz. How's things by you?
Really nice today. It's a very peaceful day. I live in Iowa nowadays, and the weather's been wonderful this year. I have no complaints at all, but I like it out east better.
Oh, okay, okay. Now, you had a minor league pitching coach, one of the Boyer boys, Cloyd Boyer. He's credited with helping you become a star pitcher. Talk a little bit about Cloyd Boyer.
Cloyd was the first real baseball name I knew because of his brother, Cleet, and then Kenny Boyer. And Cloyd was one of the Boyer brothers and also one of the Ronnie Boyer down in the minor leagues. They're just a great baseball family and really a cool guy. You know, no panic in the man, no nervousness. Just do your job. Keep your eye on where you want the ball to go. And Cloyd was just a wonderful example for me.
Great. Okay. Now, in your rookie season, 1966, you were the number two starter on the staff.
Right. I was actually the number four starter when it all started out.
Okay.
And, because we had, of course, Mel Stottlemyre, Whitey Ford, Al Downing, myself, and then Bob Friend. But at the end of the year, I ended up on top, and Mel, unfortunately, he lost 20 games, and I cannot believe the year he had and to lose 20 games for it. And it was a thrill to be there in any capacity, but with those guys on my team, my first game I walked out there, I had Mickey Mantle in center, Tommy Trash in left, Roger Maris in right, Cleet Boyer at third, and we didn't really have a shortstop yet because Tony Kubek had to retire because of neck injuries. And then Bobby Richardson, Joe Pepitone, and Allison Howard.
Exactly.
And that was the team I started with.
Amazing. Amazing lineup. Yeah, now, your major league debut was Friday, April 15th in '66 against the Orioles. down in Old Memorial Stadium in Baltimore, and you pitched a complete game.
I did. And when I walked out to the mound that day, I'd never pitched in front of a crowd that big. It was supposed to be like 44,000 people. I think they counted 38 actual thousand people. But the most I'd ever thrown before in the minors was about 2,000 people. And to go out there looking at the stands filled up just about and knowing everybody wants me to get my pants beat off was not a nice, friendly feeling.
No, exactly. Yeah, now, you won the game 3-2, your first Major League victory. A guy named Frank Robinson hit a solo home run off of you. Not too shabby, a future Hall of Famer. You got
right.
Brooks Robinson to fly out to left. Bukpa grounded out to first to give you the win. The losing pitcher was Wally Bunker, and your first you struck out three. And you remember who those guys were?
I don't.
Okay, we'll tell you.
Please do.
It was Paul Blair, Andy Etchebarren, and of course Wally Bunker.
Oh, no kidding! But I got one off of Wally.
Yeah. So at least you got him. So, but giving up a home run to Frank Robinson, that's no shame at all, Fritz. Not at all.
No, it wasn't. And Bill, it was the last inning, and I had pretty good control, and I had one out, and Frank was the next hitter, and I figured we were winning. We were ahead 3-1 at the time, and I just did not want to walk him. Even though Boog Powell was the next hitter up, Boog was left-handed.
Right.
Frank, of course, was tremendous, and so he hit one off me, and I didn't care. I really didn't. It made it 3-2, and then Boog was up, and I threw him a couple of curveballs and then a fastball on the outside part of the plate that he grounded to first base. And it was the neatest feeling I've ever had in my whole life. In fact, we had lost our first three games in New York at the opening in the opening three-game series in New York, and so this was the first win the Yankees got in 1966. And I thought they would carry me off the field on their shoulders, and they forgot to.
Yeah.
And I said, "Wait a minute! You know, this is just a big deal." And, no, I couldn't sleep all night. It was really nice. I called everybody I knew because I was in the big leagues then.
Exactly.
And it was just a thrill. Yeah.
Beautiful. Yeah. You went 12-11 that first year in 32 starts for the Yankees, 3.31 ERA, 96 strikeouts, and 215 innings. Now, you tied Stottlemyre for the team lead in wins. As you say, poor Mel lost 20 that year. And the Yankees finished in the cellar, and Johnny Keene was fired, and he was replaced by Ralph Houk.
Right. And I felt sorry for Johnny. He was a nice old guy, but he just didn't fit in with those Yankees because they had played with one of their own for their whole lifetime, Yogi Berra. And after they fired Yogi to bring Johnny in, it was just very tough for Johnny to be a Yankee manager when he was a St. Louis Cardinal most
right.
of his career.
Definitely. They thought he would be the answer, and clearly he wasn't. So they brought the major
right.
in. And you switch a uniform number from 52 to your old 19 when Bob Friend was traded over to the Mets.
Boy, you do your homework, Bill.
I do. I do, Fritz. Yeah, I got everything down.
Okay, I see.
And
yeah, I do. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
In 67, you went 8-14. Not too bad for that club. 12-11 in 68, and 69, 17 wins. 17 and in 69, 17-16. So you're moving along.
Yes, it was a thrill. And especially after that, I thought 1969 was my actual best season I ever had because I had more complete games and I had a better ERA. But it was, like you say, I was getting on, and it was so much fun to finish that year, 1969, and then come back in 1970 and be able to even better record-wise that year. But it was 1969, I think, was the better year. But the biggest thing for me in those days, right there at that time frame, was that they lowered the pension amount of years that you had to play in the big leagues to 4 years instead of five, like it was in pre-1969.
Okay.
So I knew after that season that I had become a member forever of the baseball pension plan, which was a good one.
Uh-huh.
So that took a big hit off my, you know, my shoulders as far as making money for a family.
Right.
Also, nowadays, if you have to go beyond a season of the salary these guys are getting now, you've done something wrong. You should never have to work again in your life.
Exactly. Yeah. You may have had a better season in 69, Fritz, because you had a lower ERA than you had in 69. In 69, you won 20 games. But you had a 2.9 ERA compared to 2.55, and you had more strikeouts in 68 than you did in 69.
Wow.
Yeah.
It was just, and we still were struggling. But there started to become a little bit more hope that we could get back to where we should have been all the years that the Yankees have been in such high esteem for years and years, more than any other team.
Well, you led the league in fewest walks per nine innings pitched for 5 years in a row. That's fewest walks per nine innings 5 years in a row from 68 to 72. Now, the last pitcher who did that for 5 years in a row was Cy Young. Now, that's something to be said. Did you know about that, Fritz?
I do now. I did. I learned that stuff through research that I've done for some of the books I've done. But at the time, I didn't even know they kept those stats.
Yeah.
And when I found out, it was 5 years in a row, and then you have to go all the way back to the 1800s. Really, is when Cy started his streak at that time.
Exactly.
And I think it was it really helped me to become, like that award you said I got for the lowest ERA in the history of Yankee Stadium, my walks really helped me do that, the least amount of walks, because I didn't have guys on base as much as everybody else did.
Mm-hmm.
So really, I wasn't the best pitcher they ever had, the Yankees had. I did happen to have the lowest career ERA in Yankee Stadium, and it's because of the walks. I didn't do any.
But still during this time, Fritz, the Yankees are mired, as we say, in the Horace Clark era.
Yes.
Yes.
no question about that. And I didn't know there was a name for it until after it happened.
Yeah.
But then the scholars looked back and they saw, you know, there's one guy that was very common to all those teams, and it was Horace Clark.
Poor Horace, right?
Did
you ever speak to Horace Clark about being having the nomenclature the Horace Clark era, Fritz? Did you ever speak to him about that?
Yes.
And what did Horace have to say about it?
He said, whenever he hears that term, he knows what's coming. You know, the Horace Clark era. He knows it's not good.
Yeah.
And then the sad thing was Horace is really a nice man.
Sure.
And a hard-working guy. And it's just that, you know, the Yankees were used to seeing people like Bobby Richardson, who was a better grade of second baseman and everything else. But Horace was a nice person, hard worker, but he got the name there. It could have almost been the Fritz Peterson era, because I was there almost during the same amount of time Horace was.
Or even the Mel Stottlemyre era.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, except Mel was on a winner. He was on that World Series in 1964, and Mel was just a great, great pitcher. I mean, I was always the number two guy. I mean, when it came down to the final numbers, but once in a while we'd switch off one and two, but What a pitcher, what a competitor Mel was.
But I guess Horace stood for more for futility than you guys did, which is a shame, because he was a decent ball player in his own right, as you say.
He was, and he was a hard worker.
Yeah.
He did have a hard time turning double plays, though, and that did hurt us eventually.
Yeah.
They catch up on you.
Oh, poor Horace. We're speaking to Fritz Peterson tonight on Sports Talk 1240. Well, it was during the final game at Yankee Stadium, Fritz. It was Sunday, September 21st, 2008, that ESPN announced that you had the all-time lowest ERA at Yankee Stadium, and that was 2.52. And you know who was second?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Whitey Ford.
It was Whitey, yeah, and he was 2.55, and that's pretty distinguished company, and that's permanent because the stadium's demolished now, so that stands forever.
That's right, and I think the Yankee fans or the administration would rather have had Whitey Ford have it because he was used to winning,
probably.
But I'm sorry I ain't got it, but I'm proud of it.
Exactly. Now, as we say, that stands forever. Now, it seems, Fritz, now, after the family swap and all that goes on, that's been discussed ad nauseum. After that takes place, it seems your pitching started to suffer. Why is that?
Bill, it really didn't have much, if anything, to do with the wife situation. My left arm was starting to give way. I ended up getting like 150 cortisone shots my last 2 years.
Wow!
In order to be able to go out to the mound, and it was really starting to bite away at Mel's arm too, because he ended in 74, which was. I lasted a little bit longer than him, but his arm was worn out. We pitched almost 280 innings a year for 8 or 9 years, and we just couldn't go any further.
Okay. Now, how did you feel leaving the Yankees and going to Cleveland, Fritz?
I really hated it.
Yeah.
I hate to say that about Cleveland, but Cleveland's a nice little town, even though when we went to a road trip there one time, their river was on fire. whoa, is this supposed to happen? But the odd thing about that was that I knew I was going to be traded in 74 because there just wasn't a spot for a fifth starter that year early in the season. And I went to Gabe Paul, and I said, Gabe, I know you're trying to trade me, but I said, I got to tell you this, that I won't go to two teams, the Philadelphia Phillies or the Cleveland Indians. And he patted me on the back, and he said, don't worry, young man, we wouldn't do that to you.
Oh, boy.
2 weeks later, I was on a plane with three of my teammates headed for Cleveland.
Right, yeah. And that trade, for folks who don't recall, was Fritz Peterson, Fred Bean, Steve Klein, and Tom Buskey headed to Cleveland for Chris Chambliss, Dick Chidrow, and Cecil Upshaw. And people, unfortunately for Fritz Peterson, probably remember that as a great trade for the New York Yankees. Correct, Fritz?
Yeah. And it really was. Because I was heading downhill, even though I had the next year I won 10 in a row with Cleveland. But I was heading downhill because of my arm.
Yeah.
And yet you saw what Chambliss did for the Yankees and Tidrow. And that was a pivotal trade that really put the Yankees up where they should have been.
It did. Now, you got to play for your old nemesis, Frank Robinson, in Cleveland. How was that?
Oh, that was fun. It was different because I remember him as, you know, just a tough out. And here he's my manager, and he liked me, thank goodness. And Frank was such a great player in his day, especially even then, that he had a hard time managing, I think, because things that came second nature to him, our guys couldn't do,
okay. You know,
our players.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, Frank started with a curfew and then this and that, and all of a sudden it wasn't fun anymore.
Okay.
So it wasn't that great.
That's understandable, yeah. Now, we're talking to Fritz Peterson tonight on Sports Talk 1240. His new book is called When the Yankees Were on the Fritz, Revisiting the Horace Clark Era. And what that is really a compilation of stories from when Fritz and Mel Stottlemyre were anchoring the Yankee pitching staff and some of the personalities that surrounded that ball club. And let's talk about some of those people now, Fritz. And one that I found fascinating that people may not realize played for the Yankees back in that era was Bobby Cox. Now, did you feel Bobby was going to be the great skipper that he turned out to be?
I did, because he wasn't a great player, and he had to give 100% all the time out there. And that's how Ralph Houk started. He was a backup catcher with the Yankees. And those guys have to think more about what's happening, and they can assimilate more with real people, not just stars. You know, the guys, the middle of your lineup that you really need to come through for you. And so I think I really knew Bobby was going to be like that, and I'm really glad that I got to play with him. I wanted him to play in all the crucial games that I pitched when he was on the team, because you knew that he was giving 100% no matter what. Even if he'd get hit with a ball in the face, he'd take it for you. Those are the kind of guys you want behind you, the guys that are going to give everything.
Sure, Bobby Cox. Okay, now, one guy that you talk about, and you wrote one book about the guy previously, is Mickey Mantle. Talk a little bit about the Mick.
Oh, fantastic guy. Just to show you what kind of guy he was to us nobodies, you know, the rookies in 1966. I came into spring training, and the regular players got there a couple weeks later, or a week later. And Mickey, here's Mickey. This guy looks like Popeye, just perfect athlete, a god. I mean, he almost has a halo over his head in the clubhouse. And yet, we were kind of afraid of him, and he knew that. And all of a sudden, one day, I look up from my locker stool, and there's Mickey. And he says, with his hand out, he said, "Hi, Fritz, I'm Mickey Mantle." And like I say, "Oh, really? This is God." But
yeah,
that's the way he was. And he would just make it easy to be a teammate of his, a superstar, all everything. And he was just like that, and I miss that guy to this day.
Another guy that people may want to know about, Fritz, is another guy you probably miss is Thurman Munson.
Oh, my goodness. You said it. And with Thurman, when he first started, he was like he'd been there 5 years. And like Whitey Ford told me after my first year, he said, "Now, Rook," he said, "now, I don't want you sending us Christmas cards till you're here 5 years." So I said, "Okay, Whitey." But with Thurman, even that first year, it was like he expected us to send him Christmas cards the first year. You know, but that's just the kind of cockiness he had. But he could follow it up, and just a tremendous man. The ability of anybody that you could ever think of back there. A gutsy man. He's the one you want back there for your whole life. And there was a sad day when that airplane went down, and that was my son's birthday, and it was just a very unhappy birthday.
I'm sure it was. Here's a real character that we've spoken about with a couple of other guys on the show before. He's written a book about his life, Joe Pepitone.
Yeah. Oh, Joe, what a guy. He was the jokester at the time, and can I say one kind of little bad word on your show?
Give it a try.
All right. Well, it was our first day back to New York after the spring training, and we get to fly into LaGuardia, and we were getting on the bus, and the cab driver was looking out his mirror, and our bus driver was looking out because a lot of cab drivers were beeping at him because our bus was in their way. And the bus driver turned around out the window and said, "Blow it out your ass." And Joe Pepitone says, "Hey guys, we're back." Like we're back in the city. And that was kind of neat. And Joe was funny. He one day, the guys would bet to see whose luggage came out first, and all of a sudden everybody's watching the luggage thing at the LaGuardia, and out comes Joe Pepitone, not a suitcase, but his head. And that's Joe, just fun, harmless, good guy, great ability. You know, who knows what he could have been, but he had it all. And a nice guy, loved the man.
Talented man, might have wasted a little bit of that talent, though, huh, Fritz?
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah. Good guy, Pepe, yeah. Another Yankee through and through that people loved through the years, Fritz, Bobby Mercer.
Oh, my, yes. The Lemon. And that was one of the nicest nicknames that I mean, he was kind of fit body. Not that he was ugly. He wasn't ugly at all. But sometimes he'd get that sour look on his face when he didn't like something. So I had to call him Lemon because his face was shaped a little like Lemon. But he and Kay were just, his wife, Kay Mercer, wonderful friends. They even went through my divorce situation. They were very good to my new wife, Susan, who was their friend, too. And it was a very hard situation, and those guys made it really easy to be teammates.
Now, where is Mike Kekich these days, Fritz? What's he up to?
He's out in Albuquerque, New Mexico. His wife does very. He never did marry my ex-wife,
right?
But he married some nice lady, and she does very well in real estate. And I don't know what Mike is doing actually these days. We don't really talk anymore, but he has a nice wife. I know that.
Good. Okay. Good for him. And what are you up to besides writing books these days, Fritz?
Well, I'm having a little battle with prostate cancer, and I'll find out at the end of September what I have to do now because my PSA is rising again.
Oh, no.
And it's a little touchy. So I'm going to find out what we're going. I'm graduating to another doctor.
Okay.
Which I don't think is really good, but the guy I had for the last 5 years has been wonderful, and he can't do any more for me, so I'm going up the hill a little bit. But I expect it'll be good. I expect to be around a long time. My doctor that I've had for a long time says I'm going to be here a lot longer. So I'm just planning more books and having a ball, especially with Facebook, with all the fans I have. I just love them. We're going to even do a book about them. We're going to call it Fritz's Fans Forever because they've written me stuff that I can't believe I even did. How nice how much they liked me, and it's fun. Having fun.
We'll look forward to having you back then, Fritz. I tell you, it's been a pleasure having you with us tonight, talking about your career. Our prayers are with you as far as your battle goes. I know you'll do well. The Fritz's book is called When the Yankees Were on the Fritz, Revisiting the Horace Clark Era. We appreciate you taking time out of your Sunday night to be with us, Fritz.
Bill, thank you so much, and please say hello to Doug Flynn. He's a beautiful man.
Oh, I will.
Even though he was a Met.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Bill.
Take care, okay. Fritz. Fritz Peterson, ladies and gentlemen. Next up, we'll talk to one of the principals involved in the Tom Seaver trade. Former Mets second baseman Doug Flynn joins us after the break on Sports Talk 1240. Stay with us, folks.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB. Be sure and visit us online at sportstalk1240.com.
Hey, fantasy sports fans, DraftPot is changing fantasy sports, offering the same great game without the salary cap. You can register today at draftpot.com with the promo code SPORTSTALK1240 and receive a free $5 credit. That's right. Register today at DraftPot.com using the promo code SPORTSTALK1240 and receive a free $5 credit. Do it now.
Country Foot Care, official podiatrists of the New York Lizards, have been delivering state-of-the-art foot care with good old-fashioned caring to Long Island residents for over 30 years. Specialists in sports medicine and foot injuries, Country Foot Care can be reached at 516-741-FEET or online at countryfootcare.com.
Unflippable, unflappable, unleakable. The Gust Buster is the only umbrella that won't flip inside out, rip, tear, or leak. Capable of withstanding winds over 55 miles per hour. All of our umbrellas are constructed of the finest quality materials and backed by a limited lifetime guarantee. What are you waiting for? Visit GustBuster.com and get your GustBuster today.
Whether you're a couple enjoying a romantic meal for two, a family wanting to dine in a relaxed and friendly setting, or a larger party wanting to celebrate a special occasion, Miller Place Pastoria always combines a warm welcome with the finest contemporary Italian cuisine and wines, also serving up Long Island's favorite pizza. We're located right on Route 25A in Miller Place. Come visit us today and check us out online at mppastoria.com.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, broadcasting every Sunday night beginning at 8 p.m. right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB, the station that serves your community. And now, back to the show.
All right, we're back with Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB, Freeport, New York. Bill Donahue with you. I hope you had a great weekend, beautiful summer weather. We have a sign that things may be coming to a close. The U.S. Open starting up across from Citi Field. Well, I hope you're enjoying Sports Talk 1240 tonight. Well, my next guest is probably best known as one of the players the Cincinnati Reds sent to the New York Mets in the infamous Midnight Massacre. But while with the Mets, he played a great second base, and he was a fan favorite at Shea Stadium. I welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight, Doug Flynn. Doug, good evening.
Hello, Bill. How you doing?
I'm doing great, Doug. How are you doing?
Man, it couldn't be better. The weather's perfect. Got a little golf and a little fishing in the last couple of days, so life is a dream right now.
There you go. Good man. Now, before we get started, I wanted to say hello to you from Fritz Peterson. We just had him on the show, and he wanted me to give you his regards.
Well, thank you. And back at him when you see him. We don't run into each other very often, but once you're in that fraternity of being a former ball player, it's really good when you get a chance to see guys, especially if you've played with them or against them. And, I think it's one of the best things about, not about getting older, but at least realizing that a whole lot of guys have had life after baseball.
Sure, especially passing through the portals of New York as you guys did.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Absolutely. One of the highlights of probably any career, I have a lot of people, being from Kentucky, that they wonder how I handled playing up in New York. And I said, let me tell you, if you're a pro athlete, that's the place you want to be. All you got to do is play hard, keep your mouth shut, and people will treat you really nice.
That's the way. Now, you went to the University of Kentucky. You were a Wildcat. You went on a basketball-baseball scholarship. And what I found interesting, Doug, is a couple of you guys just went to a tryout camp, and you made the cut. And you were signed by the Reds that way.
Yeah, I had some buddies that woke me up one morning. We'd been out the night before. We went over and saw the group Exile play.
Okay.
I think they were called the Exiles. And woke me up the next morning. I was in summer school at Somerset Community College. They said, we're all going to try out for the Cincinnati Reds. And I went, why not? So we headed over to the ballpark, a little place behind a elementary school building, where they were holding the tryouts, and realized that, does anybody have a glove or anybody have a pair of spikes? And sure enough, one of the guys did, and he said, you go first. And I said, sure, I will. And what I realized later, that they had no intentions of trying out, but they'd seen me play a little ball locally and felt like that if anybody had a chance to be noticed, that I may be that one. And so they sat in the stands and cheered for me, and I got an opportunity to try out. Not once or twice, but four different times. But that was certainly the beginning of my major league career, my professional career, and I'm indebted to those guys. And to this day, they remind me that I still owe them.
Exactly, yeah. And as the rest, they say, is history, right? Yeah.
Yes, sir.
And you made your major league debut on April 9th of 75 against the Dodgers at shortstop. You got an opportunity to chase Rick Rodin out of the game with your first career hit. Talk to me a little bit about Sparky Anderson with the Cincinnati Reds and the great Hall of Famer. Talk about Sparky a little bit.
Well, in those days, Sparky really wasn't a manager that liked to carry younger players on the bench, but I'd had such a good spring training. I ended up 32 for 90. And that's a lot of at-bats for a guy during spring training. And so they kept me. because they were looking for somebody to play third base. I was not a third baseman. I was never going to be a third baseman, but I was getting so much media attention because growing up 80 miles south of Cincinnati, they felt like they needed to keep me for a little while. And then there was a point in time early in the season where Pete Rose told me that if I didn't have a good game, I was probably going to be sent out because Sparky wanted me to play more, and he was going to bring an older player in to be a utility player. We already had Daryl Chaney, and as it turned out, I had a pretty decent game, and they kept me, and nothing was ever said, really. But Pete knew something was up, and he let me know about it. But I stayed there and, you know, was able to hang on and contribute a little bit for the next couple of years while we were winning. And then the trade to New York, which, you know, was really a blessing. There's a lot of stuff were going on. I knew with Tom Seaver being the franchise and such a great pitcher, it was a wonderful opportunity, I think, at the time for him, since he was going to leave New York anyway, to go to a team that looked like they had the potential to maybe win a couple of more championships. Yeah. It didn't turn out that way, but for the rest of us, it was an opportunity to get a chance to play. Zachary was doing so good before he broke his foot. Stevie Henderson had a wonderful career in Major League Baseball. Danny Norman really never quite made it, even though he had a lot of potential, but it just didn't work out. And then I was fortunate to hang around for a few years.
Well, I still want to talk about you with the Reds, Doug, for a while. I mean, you won two championships over there. And you talk about Pete Rose. Now, it doesn't hurt to have Pete Rose on your side like you did there. Talk about guys like Pete on the Cincinnati Reds. You had Tony Perez. You had Johnny Bench. You had Joe Morgan, who you took over for a while. Joe had a back injury during the 76 season, which opened the door for you, correct?
That's correct. I got a chance to go in and play every day for close to a month. He was hurt, and you know, I played pretty well during that time. And, of course, when you're playing on that team, it can be very contagious. These guys on the field were as smart of baseball people I was ever around. They were the best prepared when they came to the ballpark. They always knew who their opponent was. They knew who the opposition's pitcher was going to be. They knew what it would take to win. They knew who we had to score off early, who were guys that if they brought in from the bullpen that probably we were going to have a chance to score. So it was, you know, there were so many things that I learned just by watching them, how to play hitters, how to be a professional, basically. And I was very fortunate to break in that scenario. But you're right. When you look at that team, the guys, certainly a lot of them in the Hall of Fame, the ones that weren't, arguably Dave Concepcion could be a potential Hall of Famer in the future.
They're borderline.
George Foster.
Yeah.
Yeah, George Foster had some big years, knocking in, hitting 50 home runs. Cesar Geronimo was a Gold Glove center fielder, one of the best I ever saw. And, of course, you had Ken Griffey, who was a 300 hitter at the top of the order. And the pitchers really don't get a lot of credit, although Jack Billingham was a two-time 19-game winner. You had a great bullpen in Raleigh Eastwick and Will McEnany and Pedro Borbón and all the other guys. Don Gullett was certainly a great pitcher who came to New York. So, yeah, it was just a team that was fun to be around. And when you went to the ballpark, there was, I wouldn't say it was a cockiness, but there was a confidence that you felt like every day you went out, you could compete against anybody.
That they were going to win. Yeah, what I heard from Ken Griffey, Doug, is that Sparky Anderson wasn't really a teacher, so to speak. He didn't expect to go to the ballpark and teach anyone. He expected these guys and anybody that came to – well, they earned the moniker the Big Red Machine during this time period, I believe, during the 75-76 era. And he didn't expect to teach anyone. He expected these guys coming up to the Cincinnati Reds, coming up through that organization, to know how to play the game. And he expected.
You're exactly right, Bill.
Yeah.
Exactly right. Yeah. And, you know, as a matter of fact, everything that the way that they did their cutoffs, a lot of their signs, all the bunt plays, everything that was done in the big leagues, we were emulating down in the minor leagues so that if you were called up, you were going to know exactly where to go and what to do. And you're right, Sparky wasn't that much of a teacher. He had a great knack, though, of knowing when to take a player out of the game, a pitcher out of the game. He was able to manipulate the lineup in such a way that it was always pretty successful. And then he also had George Scherger, who was his right-hand man, that was there. Ted Klazuski was one of our coaches. Alex Grammas, Larry Shepard. These guys were all really good baseball people. But I think the best gift that he ever had was allowing guys like Johnny Bench and Pete Rose, Joe Morgan, Tony Perez to run the ball club. Sparky was the head, but these were the guys that really we looked up to. We could go to and talk about situations anytime. And I, and personally, I think one of the things that's missing from pro sports now is that it used to be policed by the players. And unfortunately now it's to the point where it has to be policed by the front office or the media or lawyers or whoever. You know, there was a time where if I wasn't hustling and I was playing against Pittsburgh Pirates, Willie Stargell would look at me and say, hey, you should have been on second base. Hey, you didn't run that ball out. Hey, you should have got to that ball. So, you know, they were they were all there respecting the game, but also policing the game.
Great point, Doug. Exactly. We're speaking to Doug Flynn tonight on Sports Talk 1240. Now, you go to the Mets, Doug. You're a guy from Kentucky. You're a guy that comes from across the river from Cincinnati. How do you initially feel when you find out that you're leaving Cincinnati and going to New York?
Scared to death.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, Pete told me, and then when I found out who I was in the trade for, it was a little intimidating because as a visiting player playing in New York, it could be intimidating just because, well, I noticed this just a couple of weeks ago when I was up in New York and saw the Mets go into first place. The crowd was unbelievable. Yeah. I mean, it was electric. I was getting cold chills just thinking, how special would it be to be on the field hearing that? You haven't scored yet. You're half a game out of first place. You're already behind in the ball game, and this crowd is there picking you up. So special. So I was a little intimidated, and, you know, I walk on the field the first time, and I got some nasty letters and got some nasty things said to me. And, you know, I remember Johnny Bench saying, hey, it's going to be good for you. You're going to get an opportunity to play, and that's why we all get in this game, because we want that chance. He said, listen to what you can from guys that are in front of you, like Buddy and Felix Mion. He said, these are guys that are professionals, and they're also great people. And I found that out when I got here. There was no animosity amongst the teammates. They all knew I didn't make the trade, so they were going to do whatever it could to help me. Matter of fact, the glove that I used for the next 7 years, I got from Jerry Grody, who had a regular fielder's glove cut down for his 12-year-old kid. And I saw it in his locker one day, and I said, hey, can I use that? He said, no, that's for my kid. I said, I'll give you two new ones, but if I could use that one, I said, it's perfect. And I used that for the rest of my time as a player. So, yeah, it can be.
That's a great, great story. Great story.
Yeah,
Doug.
But I
yeah.
wanna, you know, I want to thank those guys, though. I mean, and I have, like Kuzman and Matlack and Grody and Buddy and all those guys. They couldn't have treated me any better. And that certainly made the transition a little easier.
Excellent. Now, most of the time when you got here came it short, but you spent some time at second. The following season, they brought in Crazy Horse. You know who I'm talking about. Yeah, to play short. Then they got rid of Felix. They sent him to Japan. With the idea of using you at second. So how did you feel about that?
Well, second was my natural position.
Right.
You know, I played that in high school. And then when they signed me, they moved me over to shortstop to play for a little while. So, you know, it wasn't an uncomfortable position for me, but second was certainly a lot more natural. So I just wanted to play. And getting an opportunity to play, you didn't really care where you worked. As a matter of fact, the year after I won a Gold Glove in 1980, I started the next year at shortstop because they had brought in a young kid by the name of Kelvin Chapman.
Right, Kelvin Chapman.
And they thought he was going to be the second baseman of the future. So, I went a Gold Glove, a runner-up a Gold Glove in 78. I'm a runner-up in 79. I went in 80. And then 81, I start the season off at shortstop. So, you know, and Joe Torre, how lucky was I? I got a chance to play for Sparky and Joe Torre, two wonderful, wonderful people, two great managers. And I got a chance to play, and Joe came to me and says, look, how do you feel about playing short? I said, Joe, I just want to play. You know, you play me where you think it's best. It doesn't matter to me. And so Kelvin didn't stay very long, but they moved me back to second.
Kelvin just missed being the shortstop, the second baseman of the future.
Yeah.
A guy named Backman came along a little after that.
What a good player.
Who took that role. Let's talk about some of the other ball players. It's a shame to use the term, but during that during the Grant's Tomb era, that's another guy and I were discussing that era. That's the era that between the late 70s and when the Mets really started picking it up in the mid 80s.
Yes.
They were
getting rid of a lot of the players. I mean, Cousy left, went and won 20 games in Minnesota.
Right.
Matlack left. We had a couple of pitchers that ended up leaving that were pretty decent, but just maybe in the wrong role and maybe just hadn't matured.
You had Swan. You had Craig Swan.
Yeah, we had Mike Scott.
Right. Who I guess hadn't learned to scuff the ball yet. Right.
You said that, not me.
Yeah.
We had Jeff Reardon,
right?
Who went on and had a great career.
He really did, yeah. With the Twins, talk a little bit about Maz, Lee Mazzilli.
Love Lee Mazzilli, still do. He's, you know, here's a kid. You talking about pressure, hometown boy,
exactly.
Growing up in
yeah.
Brooklyn, coming in with a great prospect, and had some good years with us. Unfortunately, if he'd have been with another ball club, he'd probably had great years. But at that time, they were getting rid of so many of the veterans, and they were sticking a bunch of us kids in there to play. And, you know, I say kids, we were 26, 27, but as far as experience, we were kids. And it kind of threw us all in together, and, you know, we had fun, and we really loved each other. We pulled for each other. We just a little short in talent. And, of course, at the time, 1 year, though, I thought we were really going to make a good run. The Phillies came in. They were 4 games up on us. They got a 5-game set right before All-Star break. And we felt like that, you know, we could play them pretty even or at least win the series. We're right in the hunt. And they beat us 5 straight games, and they weren't even close.
Yeah.
And I told John Stearns, I said, are you telling them what pitches are coming? He said, no. And I said, well, dude, it can't be any worse. And so they ended up hammering us pretty good. But I tell you what, we had some lean years, but, boy, I tell you, I would take nothing for it. And the friendships that I've made, even over the past several years, was the fantasy camp.
Yeah.
And the folks that I got to know back then, it's priceless.
Well, Youngblood was a good ball player. I believe Joel works in the Arizona Diamondbacks organization now.
He does?
Yeah.
And... yeah, he does, and Joel's a very good ball player. But he's still there as a roving outfield hitting instructor.
Yeah. And then there was the gentleman at first base that there wasn't enough mustard to cover the guy.
You're talking about Willie, I bet.
Willie Montanez, right? I remember the San Diego Chicken used to imitate Willie Montanez running the bases after a home run. Do you remember that, Doug?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
He dropped that arm down a little bit.
That was hilarious.
Yeah, Willie was a good fella. You know, there were so many good people there. Ron Hodges.
Not
a better person than that. Yeah. Like you said, Craig Swan. Craig had a great year, led the league in the ERA 1 year.
He did, yeah.
And he could really throw. There was just a lot of really, you know, good folks there. And the fans that came out, everybody gets on the fans. They were great. There weren't many because we really weren't giving them a whole lot to cheer about. But
the loyal Met fans, Doug, will come out no matter what. I mean, you have the ones that are coming out now because the ball club is good. But the loyal Met fans will come out no matter what.
I agree. And they did then. And,
yeah.
And even today, I still hear a lot of stories about some of the guys that I meet now say how old they were when they used to come and we were playing. And I tell you, it was really a special time. It was a time where I met my wife when I was playing in New York, and we've now been married over 33 years. So there was just, you know, there's so many positives that came out of that, other than the fact that we just were not a very good ball club.
No. And, well, 79 was your best offensive season. You batted .243, you hit four homers, and you weren't a home run hitter. 61 RBIs, and you really began to emerge as one of the better fielding second basemen in the league. You led the league in putouts and double plays turned. And when did you win the Gold Glove? What year was that?
I won the Gold Glove in 80, although
in 80.
It was my best. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I finished runner-up the 2 years before, and somebody said, how do you know that? I said, well, I was told by one of the guys that voted.
Yeah.
He said, you were close. I got beat by one vote. I got beat by two votes a couple of times. And, you know, he just took a lot of pride. The defense came a lot easier for me than the offense. Plus, when you hit eight, eight's a tough place to hit in the game that we used to play. Now, you very seldom see guys taking 2-0 or 3-1.
Right.
And you put that on top of the fact that I was not a very good hitter. I had a lot of bad mechanics. I weighed 170 pounds. You know, back then, we were all somewhere in the 165 to 175 range. And when I look at these guys today that are, shoot, every player's 200, and
they've
been lifting weights,
yeah.
You're thinking, wow, there's a, you know, it was, it would probably be a little bit better now, but I tell you, you can't look back on that. You know, we did the best with what we had. For somebody that signed out of a tryout camp for $2,500.
Not too bad.
I feel very blessed.
Well, Doug was only the third Met up to that point to win the Gold Glove. Tommy Agee in 1970, and, of course, Bud Harrelson in 1971. Well, if you hit eighth, where was Buddy hitting? He must have been hitting at the top of the lineup in those days.
Yeah, Buddy hit second.
Yeah.
Buddy was hitting second usually, and then I would be down there at the bottom, Buddy was great. I tell people today, if you want to learn how to field a ground ball, go look at old videos of Buddy Harrelson, because fundamentally he did it as sound as anybody that ever played the game.
And bunting as well.
Yeah. And, you know, Buddy had good speed, too.
Yeah.
Switch hitter, had good speed. Just, I tell you, he was a gentleman. He's still a gentleman. He and Felix both couldn't have been any nicer to me. I got a couple of pictures on the wall with me and both of them that I'll always cherish because of the way that I was treated by them. So, you know, it was wonderful. Yeah, Buddy could really field. He was good. But you look, most of us were about the same size, and not only that, but we had jobs to do, move runners, try to get on so the pitcher could hit. And it was fun. It's a whole different ball game now. I get so aggravated now watching some of these players, you know, close ball game. A man on second base and no outs, and they don't try to move the runners over. It's a lot different than it used to be.
It sure is. Now, how did you feel when the Mets dealt you to Texas, Doug?
I didn't like that.
No, okay.
I didn't understand it, first of all, because I just signed a 5-year contract to stay, and I
you
wasn't
did,
so happy.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's what Mr. Cashin did. And he was, you know, in the process of putting together, they replaced me with Brian Giles.
Yeah.
And then right before Wally got into the lineup, him and Tuffle started playing. And, you know, I didn't really like it. Going to Texas was fine. I love country music, and I wore cowboy boots, so that was good. But I really thought I was at home in New York for the rest of my career. So it was a little shocking at first.
Yeah, I can imagine. Now, you've been back to Citi Field, of course.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I came back up 2 weeks ago, I guess, and was there and had a ball.
Yeah.
Got a chance. I always like to come up and visit, go down and look at a play, go to some nice restaurants, visit with a lot of friends. It's always special, and my wife's from Jersey, so, you know, she really loves coming back, too.
Great. Now, how have you been feeling, Doug?
Good.
Yeah?
My voice is hoarse. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm eating right now.
Oh, all right. Yeah, that's no, okay. I'm drinking.
No.
No, I'm only kidding.
No. No, I feel good. I'm 5.5 years cancer-free.
Yeah, good. Okay, that's what I'm.
Yeah, the one thing they did, Bill, is when I had my surgery, took my thyroid out, they nipped my vocal cords. So
yeah.
Every now and then when I'm tired, and today I played golf and was entertaining some folks. So when I talk a lot, which is all the time, my voice gets a little bit hoarse. But other than that, I feel wonderful. I feel good. And got a chance to go up to the Tony Perez statue last week. We had a little banquet the night before, and someone says, "Hey, weren't you the baby on the Big Red Machine?" And I went, "Well, close to it." There were two of us pretty close, same age. And my wife said, "Yeah, and the baby's going to draw Social Security next year." So
yeah.
It lets me know the time just keeps moving on.
You doing any singing with Johnny Bench at all, or what?
No, John and I just got back from North Carolina. We went down. We got three events that we host every year for Hope for the Warriors.
Right.
And we help raise money for the men and women that served. So Johnny's been very active. He sings every now and then when my voice clears up, I'll sing some. Matter of fact, I'm going to sing some this coming weekend with some buddies of mine up in Lexington. And we can still every now and then throw down with the fellas.
Good. That's good to hear. And you're doing some broadcasting still.
Yeah. I'm doing some Reds games. I got a radio show about fishing. I got a weekly show called Reds Weekly. And then I'm now hosting a show called Kentucky Life, where I'll travel around the state and we'll do special features on a lot of different things going on in the state of Kentucky.
Beautiful. Well, I tell you, Doug, it's been a real pleasure having you on with us tonight. I really thank you for taking time out of your Sunday night to be with us. Everyone's been looking forward to hearing from you.
Bill, all my love to all the folks up there. I appreciate their emails. They can follow me on Twitter at BL Fishing. So, you know, bring it on. Thanks so much. It's a pleasure and an honor that you would have me on. And I look forward to doing it again, buddy.
Will do. I'll keep in touch with you, Doug.
All right, Bill. Thanks,
you take care. Doug Flynn, folks.
Uh-huh.
Well, that'll do it for me tonight on Sports Talk 1240. I'd like to thank my guests, Fritz Peterson and Doug Flynn, and you for taking time to join us. Stay tuned for hour number two with Jake Brown up next on Sports Talk 1240. I'll be back with you next on Sunday, September 13th. To then, Bill Donahue wishing you a good evening, folks.
Expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.